More Confederate monuments are coming down in Texas. Last week, San Antonio removed a monument to Confederate soldiers from its downtown Travis Park. Dallas City Council voted to relocate a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee. And in August, the University of Texas took down four statues: General Robert E. Lee, Governor Jim Hogg, Senator John H. Reagan, and General Albert Sidney Johnston. Some of these names may not register with many Texans, but at one time they were all celebrated heroes. So who were they? And what did they do that was so heroic to some that it caused their likeness to be placed on a pedestal on the UT campus? Rich Heyman is a professor of geography at the Urban Studies program at the University of Texas at Austin.
They were all part of the original bequeathment by George Washington Littlefield, who was one of the early benefactors of UT. And he, in his will, left money to commemoration of the Confederacy. So he wanted to create a whole memorial that he worked with the sculptor Pompeo Coppini to create this whole memorial that was supposed to be a celebration of the Confederacy. And so there was actually the Littlefield Fountain, which is still on campus, was part of it. And then there were six statues, the four that you mentioned, as well as Woodrow Wilson, who was president at the time, and Jefferson Davis, who, of course, was the president of the Confederacy. And so the six statues together for Littlefield represented a kind of coherent commemoration and memorial to the Confederacy, even though two of them, Wilson and Hogg, didn't have any formal connections to the Confederacy. What their real connections were, what really bound all six of the figures together, was through what the Confederacy represented to Littlefield in the early 20th century, which was the ideas of white supremacy. So that Hogg was among them because he was governor in the later part of in the 1890s when the Democratic Party, which was at that time the Southern Conservative Party that wanted to reestablish exclusive white rule across Texas and the South, when they were finally able to come back into power, he was the first really powerful governor that represented the kind of resurgence of white supremacy at that time through the Democratic Party. And he was the governor who signed into law the first Jim Crow ordinances or laws and statutes in the state. The first one, which was the segregation of railroad cars, black and white railroad cars at the time. And that's what kind of initiated the Jim Crow era of formalized segregation. And Wilson, who was the other non-Confederate, also represented a white supremacy to many people. He was the first Southerner to be elected president after the Civil War, and he also was a historian by training and by his profession, and he wrote histories that were very sympathetic to the idea of the lost cause of the Confederacy. So for Littlefield, the six figures were all a coherent celebration of that, of the kind of ascendancy of white supremacy in the early 20th century when they were able to come back into power, sweep away the reforms that had been made in the Reconstruction period, and begin to disenfranchise blacks through things like purging them from the voter rolls, instituting poll taxes, instituting literacy tests, and all of those strategies were part of were Reagan's idea, John H. Reagan.
John H. Reagan is another statue that was taken down.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, what is the rationale people offer? Remove that statue of John H. Reagan. It is offensive to me. And their talking points are what?
He was a member of the government of the Confederacy. So he was the postmaster general of the Confederacy, which sounds a little bit comical in a way, like, oh,
yeah, it sounds benign.
Right, yeah, benign, exactly. But what it really meant was that he was a member of Jefferson Davis's cabinet. So he was a member of the kind of central decision-making body of the Confederacy. He was really in the government, you know, who was in charge, thinking through you know, what the whole endeavor was about. And after the war, when he was the longest living member of the Confederate cabinet, and as such, he became a spokesperson for the cause of the Confederacy and white supremacy. So he spoke often about it. He wrote about it. He gave speeches justifying secession, justifying slavery, and celebrating white supremacy. So he, those are the reasons why he's, I think people would argue that his statue should be taken down as an individual statue. Again, for some people, it's also because the whole conception that that Littlefield had of, you know, the whole thing, you, like taking them one by one, in a way kind of makes the whole thing incoherent. But thinking about why did Littlefield choose these six figures to represent some ideal for him, you know, was that they all represented white supremacy. Right, so it's not that he chose kind of great figures who sort of happened to have some dark secrets in their closet or something, right? It's not like, oh, he was great despite the fact that he was a racist, because the reason why he was chosen by Littlefield was because of his ideas about race, all six of them, and not in spite of those.
John H. Reagan was a congressman from Texas previous to the Civil War outbreak, and then he resigned and became part of the cabinet for the Confederacy. And then he was imprisoned with Jefferson Davis while Reconstruction was beginning and there was federal Union soldier occupation of Texas in the South. And he wrote this famous letter to Texas scripting out a strategy for getting rid of the Union occupation. And his goal was originally, let's get these Union soldiers out of Texas so we can go back to governing our own state. He laid out a plan saying, just do the loyalty oaths, just say what you need to say to get these guys out of here.
He wrote this letter that was, published and circulated throughout Texas. And many people did see it as him sort of selling out, saying that, you know, we need to make peace with the Union. And really, it was more like what you were saying, which was that it was about what is the minimum we can do so that we can get these Yankees out of our territory, essentially, right? And so it was much more of a practical kind of call to, okay, you know, do the oath. Let's, you know, accept certain principles, like, for example, that slavery was over. But he didn't sort of, that's why some people say that he renounced slavery. He didn't really renounce it. He sort of accepted the fact that the Confederacy lost the war, and what that meant, in fact, was that slavery was over. And therefore, what can we do now to get back to reestablishing, you know, who should properly be in charge in Texas? That's right. But in the letter and in his later writings, what he also said was, here's what we can do to minimize the impact of this situation in terms of minimizing having freed slaves and other free blacks coming into power in Texas through things like poll taxes, literacy tests, and other things. So he was really right in the aftermath of the war, while he was still in jail, he essentially had the ideas that later became the mechanisms of disenfranchising African Americans, you know, up until the 1965 Voting Rights Act.
But that was not the end of John H. Reagan's political career.
No.
He goes back to Washington, D.C.
Right, he becomes a senator from Texas.
And he goes to Washington, D.C., and he helps bring about the Interstate Commerce Commission, which is interesting because it's through the Interstate Commerce Commission that we see so much of federal authority come from.
you know, politically, there's some contradictions there.
So I'm wondering, you look at these guys like John H. Reagan and you wonder, hero or villain? Obviously, there's a lot there to say, well, you know, he did a lot of things that would be seen negative in context to civil rights. Okay, we're taking down these statues. Should at least make an attempt to try and understand who that guy was.
Yeah, that we should definitely use the opportunity to, you know, situate Reagan and the other figures that were represented in the statues, to situate them in their actual historical context, which is why I think that the statues themselves were not helping that process, that they often, you know, led people to think that these men were unambiguously heroes.
But they should be heroic without blemish.
Right. Yeah. Rather than these complicated people who, you know, were living in complicated times like we all are, right? And for me, I'll tell you this, one of the fascinating things for me about Reagan in particular was I was really interested in how it was that his reputation in our contemporary times, how was it his reputation was built around the idea that he was a compromiser, that he had sort of come back from the Civil War after being in prison and had kind of made good and had returned to Congress as a senator and had, you know, forged ahead with getting Texas, you know, getting the Union out of Texas. And that's the kind of dominant story you hear about him.
He had been reconstructed.
Well, yeah. And so I was trying to figure out, like, where does the story come from? And it turns out that there's one biography of Reagan by this guy named Ben Proctor, my historian. Ben was an undergrad at UT. And what's fascinating about this book, where most of this mythology about Reagan comes from Proctor's book, that the preface to his book, he explains why he wrote the book, why he entered into this project of writing this whole biography of Reagan. And he was at Harvard, and a colleague asked him, said, "Hey, I know you're from Texas. What do you know about John H. Reagan?" And he said, "Well, you know, I don't know anything about him except for he's one of the great statesmen of Texas. And I know that because there's this huge statue of him on campus at UT where I was an undergrad." So like you, we're saying, you know, you walk on campus, you see this statue of this man. At the time when Proctor was a student here, the statue kind of made him assume that Reagan must be this great, this unabashed great man without blemish, like you said. And so what he did, in a sense, was write the biography that matched the greatness of the statue that, you know, Littlefield had imagined, right? So it's this kind of circularity to it.
So there's a fourth statue that was taken down, and that is of Albert Sidney Johnston.
He fought in three different armies. He was in the U.S. Army, the Army of the Republic of Texas, and also in the Confederate Army. And for a while, he lived in California when he was in the U.S. Army. So he has, you know, this long military career as this general in three different armies. And he was also the highest-ranking military figure on either side to be killed during the war. But I think that the reason why his statue was here on campus, again, goes back to George Washington Littlefield. So as I said before, Littlefield was one of the, you know, great benefactor of UT who paid for these statues. He himself was a soldier in the Confederacy, and his commanding officer was Johnston. And Johnston was killed at the Battle of Shiloh in 1862. And so Johnston became also a figure in the Confederacy, this kind of mythological martyr figure, because he died relatively early on in the war, And he was seen at the time as having, you know, this great promise as a military leader, as a great general and things like that, and that his death was contributed to the eventual defeat of the Confederacy. But for Littlefield, it was much more personal connection, because Littlefield was gravely wounded at the Battle of Shiloh and never returned to active duty after that. He almost died from a leg wound, and the rest of his life he walked with a pretty severe limp, and all the pictures you see of him, he's leaning on a cane. So for him, I think there was also that personal connection to Johnston, that as well as the kind of larger narrative that Johnston represented, the kind of greatness of the Southern cause that had been lost.
There's a not just the statue at UT, but which is now gone, but also a very ornate cemetery plot for him at the Texas State Cemetery, a statue of him there lying in repose, which is very impressive. And people will walk past that and say, this man must have been pretty important, but I have no idea who he is. I mean, it's amazing how these statues go up and their names fade.
Yeah, it's interesting, as you said, really ornate memorial to him at the cemetery. It was itself not put up until the early 20th century. He wasn't initially buried here in Austin. He was buried, I think, in New Orleans after he died at Shiloh, several years after the war, his body was moved, and then it was 40 some odd years later that the memorial was built. At that time, again, the early 20th century, when there was that more a big push to commemorate the South as white supremacists came back into power in Texas and across the South.
So there was this deliberate attempt, because there was a joint resolution by the Texas legislature to move the body of the remains from New Orleans in 1866 and bring it back to Texas, and then 40 years later appointing someone to design a monument in at this gravesite. I mean, this was part of this deliberate attempt to venerate these people that were part of the Confederacy in order to keep telling the story and to solidify, crystallize what it is they wanted people to know about that era.
Yeah.
And so now here we are today saying, well, let's take another look.
Yeah. And I think learning history through statues is probably not the best way to learn history.
We can learn the history of why we decide to make statues and the logic behind that. And sometimes that logic is flawed. And it is part it's a political problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's interesting to see, like, our current moment in its historical context, the moment when Littlefield wanted, you know, to put up the statues as a different moment in history. And then the Civil War is yet another moment in history, so that we can think about them as separate times, instead of, you know, when Littlefield and you know, you're saying this deliberate attempt to tell the story of the Civil War in the early 20th century, we need to understand what was happening then and why they wanted to tell the story in a certain way that helps us to understand what those statues are about. And in a way, it tells us a little bit more about what was happening in the early 20th century as much as it tells us about what was happening during the Civil War, what the Civil War was about.
Rich Heyman is a professor of geography in the Urban Studies program at the University of Texas at Austin.